There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that is a roundup of the best bits of today's show from Monday, the 24th of February.
Let's get some more now on our top story, which is that report from the UAE Central Bank, 2.9% growth, they're saying here in the UAE. We've got an Instagram poll going on this morning, and we're asking you very simply, that's what the data says, but how do you feel about the economy at the moment, weak or strong? 62% say weak, 38% say strong. Going to get the thoughts of Daniel Richard from Emirates NBD in a second, and the thoughts of the economist or analyst from Standard & Poor's, Zahabia Gupta. First of all, though, Tom, we've been chatting to various guests about this, and there's a prevailing narrative, isn't there, that it's weak at the moment and that business is tough. But then if we think about the people we've been speaking to over the past few days, many of them have come in and said, you know what, business is really busy. For example, Anna from Airbnb, or Anna Skiggin from Frank Porter, who works in the Airbnb business, business is booming for them. Yeah, they've had a few cancellations because of coronavirus in February, but essentially the trajectory is up and up and up. The Hunter Foods guys making snacks and chips, launching new shawarma varieties, really busy, a 40% increase in revenue. Who else was it we spoke to yesterday who you remembered?
You know, the leasing guy, the aviation leasing guy.
Feroz Tarapur.
Feroz Tarapur, yeah.
$1.5 billion profit last year.
That's not bad, is it?
Which is all right. He said, yeah, coronavirus will give us a bit of a hit, but basically we expect to do as well, if not better, Dubai-based company. So we're not saying that there isn't weakness out there, but sometimes that prevailing narrative of, oh, it's tough at the moment, can become overwhelming.
And we've had lots of entrepreneurs and startup investors in recently as well, people who have gone out on their own in recent times, have left good jobs behind to launch their own apps, launch their own startups in a number of different sort of areas of e-commerce. And all of them are saying boom time at the moment, absolute boom town. And regardless of the fact that there are more and more out there and there is a lessening of the pot, of the investor pot, if you want, there are more opportunities than ever before. So that would feed into the whole mantra of the diversification away from oil and fuel industries.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question there's weakness out there at the moment. Retail in particular, we know that the hospitality industry has its challenges. Someone's just written in saying DIFC challenges there. So yeah, absolutely there are challenges, not disputing that, but it's perhaps more a balanced picture than sometimes we paint here. Anyway, that's the anecdotal evidence. What about the data? New central bank report came out and it said 2.9% growth last year. We thought that seemed a little bit high for what was a fairly lukewarm economy last year. So we spoke to Daniel Richard, senior MENA economist at Emirates NBD, and asked him for the story behind that number.
So this estimate from the central bank of 2.9% is not a final figure, but it's quite a strong estimate. At least we had penciled in 2%. Crucially, a lot of this growth is coming from, according to this statement, from a 7.6% expansion they saw in hydrocarbon sector. And that's much stronger than we'd expected because of the ongoing OPEC production cuts, which has served to stimulate growth in oil production. But according to the bank, this strong growth came thanks to condensates and natural gas production in particular. Perhaps more concerning, though, and more pressing to my listeners, is how the bank estimates for non-oil sector performed. And here they're more bearish from what we had penciled in. We had estimated 1.6% growth in non-oil sector last year, but they have said just 1.1%, down from 1.3% the previous year.
So, what have been the dynamics in the non-oil sector with just 1% growth?
We've seen a number of weights on the non-oil sector last year. In particular, monetary policy was one of the factors. We had a number of rate hikes that came in the previous year, and that really weighed on some demands. We do expect an improvement this year in that regard. There's a number of factors that should boost non-oil private sector growth. We have the Expo event, of course, coming in. We also have greater government spending. This perhaps hasn't been to the degree that might have boosted the economy, but reassuringly, the central bank statement said that it did rise 3.3% in the last quarter compared to decline the quarter before that. So that should help boost activity as well. And also looser monetary policy should give a bit of a boost this year too.
That's Daniel Richards of Emirates NPD. Messages coming in, Tom, aren't they? Someone writes in, no name on this. Well, maybe let us know your name. Yeah, but all of those business you mention are instant gratification ones. Which is a fair point. Thanks very much indeed. What about outside of technology? Well, aircraft leasing, we just mentioned, is a very kind of old economy type business, isn't it? But keep your messages coming.
Food,
yeah, snacks. Yeah. But yeah, the guys from Hunter Foods, they make chips. They're up 40% year on year. So it's not just tech, but they are innovating. They're looking at healthier options, like rather than just deep fried potatoes, they're doing deep fried kale and vegetables. Healthier, if not healthy. Mm. New flavours, shawarma flavoured chips and things like that. I don't know. Look, I'm just throwing it out there. Keep your messages coming. We have had a dose of reality this morning when we spoke to the guys from S&P Global Ratings, Zahabia Gupta. They're paid to give honest ratings. They can't sugarcoat anything. They've just got to give their honest view. And we asked Zahabia to join us actually to talk about Lebanon, first of all. But because this central bank report from the UAE broke overnight, we asked her to give us her take on the UAE economy. Now, bizarrely, S&P doesn't rate the UAE because as a country, we don't issue bond and debt. But what they do rate is some of the individual emirates, like Abu Dhabi, like Sharjah. So we asked her, given all of that, given the central bank report, what's your view of the picture you're seeing in the Emirates?
Overall, the macro picture in the UAE is looking weaker than it did before. I mean, we've seen the 2019 figures for the UAE that the central bank has published. And what is striking is that majority of that growth is coming from oil. And from what we understand is that that's largely because of growth in condensates and natural gas. But when we look at the macro picture for Abu Dhabi, we do expect some non-oil growth this year because of the stimulus funds that are going to be injected. Last year was a little disappointing in terms of the funds that were disbursed. This year, we expect majority of that to come.
This is the Ghadan 21 project.
Exactly. This is the Ghadan 21 fiscal stimulus program of 50 billion dirhams over 3 years. Having said that, the reason why I said the macro outlook is looking weaker is because, well, first, coronavirus. I mean, as you mentioned, it has a direct impact on oil prices, which the region very much depends on. But indirectly as well, it affects travel and tourism. It affects weak investor sentiment for real estate, for retail as well. A lot depends on how long the infections continue and how severe they are. Our base case is that the infections will peak in March and we should see a V-shaped recovery from that. And if that's the case, then we should see limited demand in the GCC. The other factor is also just the geopolitical tensions that we see in the region. It has an indirect impact on the economies as well because of just weaker sentiment regarding real estate, regarding travel to some extent too. And that's why we do expect that growth should be weaker across the GCC, not just for Abu Dhabi, but in the region.
Zahabia Gupta there of Sovereign Ratings Agency, S&P Global Ratings. More messages coming in on this. Again, no name on it. Someone else writes, let's take DAE, Dubai Aerospace Enterprise, which we mentioned, the leasing company. Revenues didn't grow from 2018 to 19. You can't use that as an example of success. I don't know. They made 1.5 billion dirhams last year. And that's quite successful. I mean, you're right, they're not growing massively. But this person, again, no name, says, Dubai is not a developed country. You need growth of 5 to 6% a year to survive. Maybe take issue with that, but it's a valid point and we appreciate you sending them in.
Sue's also texted saying that construction ain't in a good place at the moment, but that's not anything new. I've been here for a while and I've talked to a lot of people in construction. That seems to have been there for quite some time, but things still go up.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's go back to that news out of Abu Dhabi yesterday, where a new tourism fee has been agreed governing short-term rental markets in Abu Dhabi. What do we know? The additional charge for Airbnb-style holiday homes must not exceed 6% of the guest bill, according to the legislation drafted by the Abu Dhabi Executive Council. To give more thought on this one, we've been joined in studio by the CEO of Frank Porter. Anna Keegan joins us live here in studio. Anna, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, for listeners out there that aren't aware of Frank Porter's relationship with short-term rentals, talk to us about the company. What do you do?
So Frank Porter is a management company. What we do is we help people put their homes up for short-term rental. We do everything from furnishing, photography, and then dealing with guest issues. So checking in guests, checking out guests, maintenance. So everything, the full package to help you turn your home into a holiday home.
Before we move to Abu Dhabi, can we stay here in Dubai first? Because this is something we saw, what was it, September last year or something in downtown Dubai, where authorities down there tried to regulate short-term rental. They did it very lastminute.com as well. There wasn't much yeah. warning for it as well. Where are we at? That was September last year. Is that still in place?
No, I mean, it was, they tried, but there's a new decree that just went out a few months ago, new regulations that were put up by the DTCM, which is the governing body in Dubai for tourism, that said that you absolutely can do short-term rentals with your home. There's no developer that can stop you as long as there's nothing in your SPA that prohibits it. Anyone who has a home and a property here can rent it as a holiday home.
Mm. I mean, one of the issues that I know from individuals that were involved that time was the way it was handled down there. It was very last minute. There wasn't any warning as well. Is that the same with these new regulations in Abu Dhabi, or the fact that there is a bit more transparency? Is that helping?
No, that's helping a lot. We're so excited about Abu Dhabi at the moment. We were expecting some rules to come into place, and we're very happy that it's come now, way ahead of the expo, way ahead of the sort of next season. So we have time to prepare. Abu Dhabi is such an amazing, incredible city. And there is a lot of holiday homes there already that are operating probably, without the rules. So it's great to have these regulations, these rules, these clear definitions of how to operate in that market.
We talked about the DCTM figures coming out a little earlier on the show, the fact that there are more visitors coming into Abu Dhabi, so significant market. From the way that you've read this new resolution as well, these new fees, how much is it going to cost operators? And it come down to the owner, or is it operators like you that have to foot the bill?
Well, I think because it's news, it's very new regulation. Yeah. We're not sure exactly how it will be when you start operating. We know that it's up to 6%. That's what they say, that you have to pay on top of the guest reservation, but we're not sure exactly how it will be taken. You know, the rules are very different here than there. So I think once we start, we'll know exactly how it affects the bottom line.
The resolution, and I quote, aims to enhance the reputation of the Emirates as a leading destination for high quality hospitality. Is that where the money is going to maintaining that standards are kept high?
Yes, I think so. For sure here, you know, we have a tourism tax here in Dubai that we pay on a monthly basis to the government, and Abu Dhabi is going to do the same. Hmm. It's just going to be a bit different. Here you pay a fixed fee per night. There, clearly, they want a percentage of the entire reservation. So we just need to see how it all play out once we start operating there.
This is obviously a very evolving market at the moment. A lot of people involved as well. I'll read you a little text message that came through from one of our listeners earlier when we teased this subject, saying, come on, guys, protect your hoteliers. We are getting, can't say what he wrote then, but done by this at the moment. Do we need to find more of a level playing field between hoteliers and, of course, short-term rentals?
Well, I think you just have to look abroad to more mature markets like in New York or London, where you have hotels and you have short-term rentals and people are operating at the same time and it's not a huge issue. So I think we just have to look to those more mature markets to see where Dubai is going, where Abu Dhabi is going,
Airbnb reportedly lost money last year, but that was because they said costs were ballooning, demand was there as well. How's 2020 look for Airbnb and similar projects here in Dubai and the UAE as a whole?
Well, I think Airbnb is preparing for their IPO, which should be this year, next year. I mean, they're growing. You know, there's markets where they're already quite big in. And then there's new markets, for example, like here, like the Gulf, Saudi Arabia is going to be a big market where they're going to grow. So I think Airbnb will just continue to grow in new and evolving markets. You know, everybody wants cheaper accommodation. Not everybody can afford a hotel. And Airbnb being able to rent apartments opens up the market for more tourists, which is always a good thing. It's not just people middle class and above that get to travel, you know. It's everybody that can get, that should be able to travel and use accommodation.
So things looking good for 2020.
Yeah, 100%. We're so excited about the expo. We're so excited about these regulations. You know, I think UAE is evolving as a tourist destination. Abu Dhabi is a great addition to that. There's so many things to see. So we're very excited about it.
Very good place to leave it. CEO Frank Porter, Anna Skiggin, thank you very much indeed
thank
for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Natasha Thomas with us in the studio to look through the papers and indeed the ARN News Centre app. Morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Richard.
Let's begin with the top local story, which is tenants moving back into an apartment block after a fire.
Yes, that's right. So the Duja Tower in Dubai, there was a fire and now more than 300 tenants have moved back 36 hours after this particular building caught fire. Now, their flats have been given the all clear by the civil defense, while the municipality also found that the tower's structure has not been effective. Alternative accommodation has been provided to the other residents whose apartments have not been cleared yet. Now, this particular building was on Sheikh Zayed Road or is on Sheikh Zayed Road. It caught fire on Thursday night. Authorities are still trying to figure out what exactly happened and why it caught fire. And we'll be speaking to a resident of the tower later this afternoon to find out how they are coping.
Well, I'm going to bring in now one landlord who has experience of this, owning real estate in a tower block that has caught fire. Tom Urquhart with us in the studio.
Well, thank you for that.
Not once, but twice, Tom.
Yeah.
This is one of the towers in the marina that's had fires. Thankfully, nobody was hurt in the apartments that you own. But how did you get back to business? What was the process or the system?
I'd love to say that we did, but we never really did. I mean, people have gone back. We've been able to rent it out. Residents have moved into said tower, etc., which is no big secret. But it's certainly been affected by that. There is a sort of reputation element. You speak to any other property owner here or any other property developer here, and you get mentioned where you've got a property, and oh yeah, okay, cool. I don't think that, you know, tenants are willing to give it a go, especially when you get a much better rent, which is...
But the rent is what, 20% below equivalent apartments next door either side, something like that?
Yeah, probably a bit more than that.
Really?
Yeah. It's not been great. Can we move on?
Yes. Road diversions in place for the UAE tour.
I've been in therapy for a while over it, so thanks for taking me back.
Sorry, mate. Road diversions in place for the UAE tour.
Well, yes, so motorists can expect more traffic diversions today as stage two of the UAE Tour Cycling gets underway. Dubai residents will be glad to know that it's not in the city today, so they can't expect any delays. But in Fujairah, the race starts from Hatta Heritage Village. It'll pass through Fujairah and finish 168 kilometres later at the Hatta Dam. So residents there can expect some delays. Rolling road closures will be in place along the route between 12:15 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. Some of the areas affected are Hatta Fort Roundabout, Wadi Al-Khur Street, Shauka Street and Sheikh Khalifa Road. And all those details are up on the ARN News Centre app.
I mean, I mentioned this last week when the ladies' tour was happening. Hatta Dam. I was there a few weeks ago. The road up to Hatta Dam, it's almost vertical.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you couldn't cycle up it or down it. You couldn't.
You can if you're a world-class athlete.
You have to if you want to get past stage two today, because that's yes. Exactly where they're taking
you. I mean, it's only about 300 metres, but it's really, really, really steep. But those last 300 metres, maybe you'd have to go to the top of the dam. I don't know. Anyway, it's very steep up there. Finally, let's talk about India. President Donald Trump of the United States begins his tour of India today, Natasha.
Yes, so this is President Donald Trump's first official trip to India. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of excitement in the country, specifically in Gujarat, which is the home state of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and which is his first stop. And now, if you look at Indian media, there are live updates. There's live streaming of the ceremony. In about an hour, he will be touching down in Ahmedabad, which is the city in Gujarat. He's also been tweeting in Hindi, which I found quite interesting. So he said, "Hum Bharat aane ke liye tatpar hain, hum raste mein hain, kuch hi ghanton mein hum sab se milenge," which is, I'm really keen to visit India. I'm on my way and I can't wait to meet everyone in a few hours. So I imagine he was tweeting on his plane or somebody was tweeting for him.
Possibly the latter.
Yes.
He's also going to be visiting the Taj Mahal, isn't he?
He is, yes. Agra is also on the itinerary. But what's really making headlines, a side story, it's a wall. You know, it's been a narrative in Mr. Trump's presidency, a wall. And this time, this particular wall is in the city of Ahmedabad. And there's a lot of controversy around it. What's happening is that the highlight of the tour is the Namaste Trump reception, which will be at a newly built cricket stadium in the suburb of Motera, which is a few kilometers away from the main airport in Ahmedabad. So in order to get to the stadium, the presidential motorcade will have to drive past a slum development. Now, authorities have been sprucing up the area, as is the case in India whenever we have visiting dignitaries. So the pavements will get a lick of paint, the roads will get paved. And in this case, they're also blocking the view of what authorities are consider quite unsightly. So they've built a 4 feet high wall, which is blocking this particular slum, and it's not been going down well. So the 5,000 odd residents of this area are complaining about the wall, but local officials insist that they had always planned to build this particular wall and it has nothing to do with Mr. Trump's visit.
I'm looking at live pictures, actually. The airport at Ahmedabad, they are waiting for Air Force One to land, but it hasn't quite arrived yet.
No.
But they've got the step ladders are already out. And it's not just President Trump, isn't it? It's the First Lady as well. First daughter is coming.
Yes.
There's quite a big delegation.
The son-in-law.
First son-in-law.
Yes. It's a big deal in India. And overall, you know, in terms of partnerships, agreements, etc. In terms of business, they're expecting a lot out of this particular visit.
My favourite bit of this is that he's going to visit the Taj Mahal. But it's not his first visit to the Taj Mahal. It's his first visit to the real one. But back in 1990, this happened.
Amidst great hoopla this week, Donald Trump is opening his $1 billion Taj Mahal casino in Atlantic City. Some economists call it a reckless gamble. But the customers we talk to seem to like it just fine.
This is truly the eighth wonder of the world.
We think the Taj Mahal is beyond belief from any standpoint, and we think it's going to be a tremendous success.
It wasn't a tremendous success. It's shut down. One report says it was sold for 4 cents in the dollar. That's even worse than Tom's real estate record, isn't it? Which is saying something.
Make me feel a lot better about myself now. Just a quick question, though. If you are going to build a $1 billion replica of the Taj Mahal, whatever it might be, wouldn't you think of like visiting the Taj Mahal in the first place for a bit of inspiration?
A few sketches. The Trump's Taj Mahal, doesn't. It was not a replica.
No.
It's just
no.
A big tower block.
Okay.
With the words Taj Mahal painted on it. Yeah, he didn't even bother building a replica.
Do you know what's interesting is another thing. The Taj Mahal is actually, the tombs inside are being cleaned up for the first time in 300 years for Donald Trump.
Well, they're going to put him in there.
Thomas! You're listening to the Business
Close
Breakfast
the door.
To buy iWallet 3.8.
Wrap him up.
Natasha Thomas, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk technology now with one of the biggest Dubai fintech companies that you've almost certainly never heard of, but have almost certainly used. We're talking about Marshall. Who? Yeah, Marshall. It's a company. It's been around since the 80s, and it powers payments whenever you go shopping. The boss, Gaurav Dar, is here to reveal why they've just been bought, or at least 70% of it has just been bought, by Bahraini investors GFH, and he's with us in the studio. Gaurav, good morning. Thanks for being with us. So, we're going to ask why this deal and what difference it makes in a second, but first of all, let's rewind in a bit of a history lesson. Marshall started off in the 1970s and 80s here in Dubai, As a furniture company. Give us a 30-second version of how you got from selling furniture to a big fintech takeover.
Well, my father was a legacy in technology. He used to work for Texas Instruments. He came to Dubai and started his career and soon wanted to be his own boss. Joined a company, but it was furniture company. And he said, well, this can't survive long term. How do we create value for customers long term? And that was in technology. And he started with Microsoft and he evolved more by traveling to the US and Europe. And then finally landed on payment technology back in 1983.
So 1984. In very simple terms, and I am oversimplifying, the little boxes, the point of sale machines, when we, well, now swipe our credit card or tap our credit card, you supply those. But you say the trick is not in supplying the boxes because they're just generic bits of kit. You write the code that powers them, tens of thousands of these things every year.
Correct. And, you know, it's life cycle. We actually, you know, we treat these little boxes like they're our own family from start to finish, whether it's repairing them, looking after them. Every bit of intelligence and interaction that it does securely for any financial instrument, whether it's a card scheme or whether it's for petroleum, it's all done by us.
Here in your office in Deira?
Oh, yeah. We only have one office, yeah. And we operate in 20 countries.
So, over the past few days, GFH, the Bahraini Investment Bank, has bought a 70% stake in your company. And honestly, that's the only reason I've heard of you, because that happened. I thought, who on earth is this fintech company they've bought? GFH is the company that a year or so ago bought a big stake in The Entertainer for more than $100 million. What can you tell us about how much they've paid for Marshall?
I can say they got value for money, but I can't tell you more than that, unfortunately.
You could tell me, but then you'd have to shoot me.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Fair enough. There's a non-disclosure. But they've bought 70% of the company, but you've retained 30% and full management control.
That's right. You know, GFH as a partner, we've had several acquisition offers over the last 5 years as the fintech topic has really heated up. And people have seen us as a strategic point to review investments in this market. And they reviewed our synergy, our future, our roadmap for the next 5 years. And they said, don't change anything. We're here to help you. And they really aligned with us. And that's why they said, listen, you guys keep doing what you're doing. We're here to support you. And they've been fantastic, really.
I'll tell you what's really interesting about this. When we think of fintech, and we're guilty of this as journalists, we think of fintech incubators in DIFC or in Abu Dhabi and 23-year-olds wearing trainers with a smart idea. But you're a 40, 50-year-old company in an untrendy area of Deira, and you're a fintech company. You don't fit the stereotypical profile.
I'm so happy for that because I can continue doing the work that I'm doing. But now that you mentioned the part about fintechs and incubators and accelerators, we've been investing in companies globally for the last 3 years. And, you know, Amazon has followed me into investments. SoftBank has followed me into investments because of this, because we're able to see trends in adoption of technology from the consumer to the merchant to the region so granularly and so well that even these big giants follow us onto investments.
Okay, fine. Well, I'm keen to jump on that bandwagon and hang on those coattails. Where are you and SoftBank and Amazon investing?
Yeah, I mean, looking at technology that basically destroys the barriers between, distributing access to technology and financial services. So our thesis is hardware and software agnostic.
Okay. I don't know what that means.
we'll get into that a bit more. But it basically means the connecting points in the ecosystem that inherently provide barriers for someone to consume a piece of technology. It takes 7 years. It's 5 to 7 years for someone to consume a piece of technology from the point it's invented to the time it gets into your hands and actually scales through the market.
Okay.
And that we're able to look at the entire market. I'm fortunate to look at that and shrink it down and say, how do we...
So can you give me some specific examples of companies that you've bought into or invested in?
Sure. So one example is a company that we looked at in India that uses sound waves to do transactions. So instead of using NFC, Bluetooth, we actually use sound waves to communicate between two devices. So if you look at it, every single device in your ecosystem has a speaker or a mic.
Okay.
And we securely send data over sound waves encrypted for you to be able to do an interaction or a transaction. So what we're saying is, no matter what device you have, as long as you've got a phone, we can put any software and communicate to any hardware.
And is that better than, for example, Bluetooth or Wi-Fi that we're used to?
Better is one terminology that has to be framed. I would say it is the only piece of technology that is universal and ubiquitous against legacy infrastructure and future technology. So Bluetooth and NFC, for example, requires you to have a Bluetooth or an NFC device. Whereas already, if I'm looking at not spending money, and I'm disrupting my own business here, if you're not looking at spending money on a hardware device, we can communicate and connect securely through every device that already exists today.
Final question, 30 seconds. You've been taken over by the guys at GFH, or 70% of it. Culturally, that brings changes. Never mind the business model or the technology. You have been a family-owned business, essentially, for 40 years, and now suddenly you've got investment bankers in Bahrain breathing down your neck because they own 70% of your business. How are you going to deal with that?
So we're a very lean company and a small company, as you know. So from that
you're about, 50, 60 people?
45 to 50 employees. So from our point of view, you know, there's over-governance is something that GFH is very well aware of. So they don't want to get into that, not let alone me. So what's happening from there is structure. A bit of structure is happening, but not over governance. And like I said, the roadmap, we've already been planning for the next 5 years. So they're on track with us.
Fascinating story. From a furniture company in Dera to a fintech buyout, Gaurav Dhar is the CEO of Marshall Equipment. Appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.